I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, as Democrats and Republicans debate their new leadership, a familiar name resurfaces. But first to Iraq. Officials say about 70 of the people abducted in that brazen raid on the offices of the Higher Education Ministry have been released, but officials still can't pinpoint the number that remain captive. Yesterday's kidnappings were the latest to target Iraqi academics. Last month, a Sunni professor and the Shiite dean of Baghdad University's economics department were assassinated. But while that violence has forced some schools to shut down, most, including Baghdad University, are still open. Dr. Moussa Jad Aziz is the president of Baghdad University. He joins us now on a shaky phone line from his office, so we'll listen closely. And Dr. Aziz, we know that many of the kidnapped were employees of the education ministry, but there were also students who were there to apply for scholarships to study outside Iraq. Why do you think academics are being targeted?
The terrorists usually follow the easiest pathway. So the easiest way is to murder or assassinate a university professor who is usually non-armed and used to be busy with his science and, of course, has not the ability to defend himself like the insurgents. Secondly, the publicity behind this is great. And, of course, most of the people consider killing a university professor as a great thing, so that the terrorists always follow this way in order to gain their reputation.
So you think it's for the publicity and, you know, for the honor of killing someone of such esteem, a professor, and also because, as you say, professors aren't armed and they're busy with their science. Do you worry that you're seeing in Iraq the beginning of something we've seen in other countries, Cambodia, for instance, where all the intellectuals were killed to remove, you know, free thought? Do you worry about that?
Well, actually, we are not worried that these operations will stop the universities in Iraq and the students from getting their science.
You say you're not worried that this will stop the studies and or shut down the university. You say you think these people are terrorists. Who do you think they are? Who would want to target professors?
The people who targeted university professors, I think they are not educated enough or understand the great position of a university professor, and therefore killing this man will cause a chaos, because if the universities will close, the whole country will be in total chaos.
So you think that these people, perhaps uneducated, are hoping to cause chaos and hoping to close universities, although you've said that that won't happen. We understand that people of every persuasion were working together at the ministry that was attacked yesterday by the kidnappers. There were Sunni, Shia, Christian, and Kurdish Iraqis all working there. Do you think that educated people in Iraq tend to be less sectarian? Is that perhaps also why they were targeted?
Well, I can assure you, this has nothing to do with the sectarian. While in this office, the ministry office, the whole staff and the attendants are from all sects.
Right. This was not sectarian violence. This was all different sects, as you said, Sunni, Shia, Christian, Kurds working together. May I ask, what sect do you belong to?
I think this will not help you at all. Whether you know that or not, it will not help you. Please ask the second question.
Don't ask that question. I'm understanding you.
Your question has nothing to do with your career. I am an educated man, and I am responsible of a university. Whether I am from any sect, this will add nothing to your knowledge. We are all working at the same places from all sects, and especially the educated people, has nothing to do with the sectarian, and there is no discussion about this matter, and they act as brother or colleagues or friends.
Dr. Aziz, we hear about the flight of the educated middle class and of academics, teachers, educators from Iraq. Are you feeling that? Are you feeling colleagues who are saying they can't stay because of the violence?
They have to stay unless they are threatened. Yeah. Because if everybody will migrate, who is going to teach the Iraqi students? Shall we import professors from outside Iraq. Shall we buy the science? We have thousands of educated people and professors, Iraqi professors, and it is unacceptable to stop the studies if the professor is not threatened or have some problems with the sort of life we are now suffering in Iraq. We have to suffer. We have to serve our country. We have to teach our students. And at the end of the day, definitely, we will have the victory.
It sounds as if you've just answered another question of mine. I was going to ask, why do you stay?
I am stay for the same reason. I have to teach our students. I have to do something for my country. If I also migrate, then nobody will stay in Iraq. And therefore, the country will be obliged to import professors from outside Iraq.
Dr. Moza Jad Aziz, president of Baghdad University, speaking to us from the university today. Dr. Aziz, thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Well, they say everything old is new again. Republican lawmakers in Congress have tapped former Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott of Mississippi as the new minority whip. Lott was ousted as majority leader 4 years ago after making this remark at the now late Senator Strom Thurmond's 100th birthday party.
When Strom Thurmond ran for president, we voted for him. We're proud of it. And if the rest of the country had followed our lead, we wouldn't have had all these problems over all these years either.
Well, that remark was considered racially insensitive because at the time Thurmond ran for president in 1948, he was a strict segregationist. Lott has since apologized, and today he seemingly came out of nowhere to win the number two Republican spot in the Senate. Well, there's a lot going on today on Capitol Hill, and we want to look at it, starting with Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, welcome as always.
Glad to be here.
And outgoing Senator Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania is the one who told reporters that Lott won this minority whip spot in a secret ballot by just one vote, nosing out Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee. Now, we thought Alexander, I think yesterday, had said that he thought he was going to win by 30 votes. So,
This is the genius of electing a whip whose job it is to catch a vote, to count votes by a secret vote. The one who really can count the votes is the one who wins.
And explain what they mean by count the vote. They mean ensure that you have the votes.
That's right. A whip's job, you know, the majority leader doesn't want to go onto the floor with a big vote and lose. So they turn to the whip, who is responsible for keeping in very close touch with members to find out what it is they need, where they stand on a vote, and most importantly, is that vote solid going into it?
Right.
There are, I can think of almost no leadership election where someone hasn't claimed they had all the votes and then not had them. That seems to be more a pattern here than not.
So Senator Lamar Alexander, by saying that he had more votes than he had, was probably, as you're saying, perhaps demonstrating that he maybe shouldn't be the whip.
Not quite ready,
yeah.
Although he is immensely respected. It's interesting, he's not one of the more forward members of the Republican caucus. He doesn't rush for television cameras. But talking to members, he really is deeply respected. They respect his intelligence, what he's learned about the institution. This is a former cabinet secretary, presidential candidate, and governor. I don't think you've seen the end of him at all.
Well, but why did Lott pull this off? I mean, I know there's a lot of last-minute lobbying, but what does he do? What does he say? And why are the members, embracing him?
He said something very simple. He said, I'm doing the job I love the most, counting votes. You know, the Senate historian told me yesterday that this is the first time that a majority leader has ever taken a demotion or sought a demotion. But Trent Lott loves politics. I mean, he just exudes it. He's one of these happy warriors on the Hill. You can't imagine him, in private life or as a lobbyist. He likes being a senator, and I think he really missed leadership. And I think his colleagues missed the kind of steady hand and knowledge of the floor that Bill Frist, former surgeon, didn't really have.
Well, Lott is now going to be second in command to Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, who was elected unanimously as Senate Minority Leader. And just remind us, obviously we know that Lott will be, counting the votes, but strong-arming may be too strong a word, but is that a part of this role as well?
Typically it is, but I think it's more when the whip is in the majority that you have all these favors to give out. The Republicans, oddly enough, I think are going to be much more united in minority than they were in the majority, precisely because they are looking. It's incredible to me how much people are already focusing on 2008 and what it will take to get their gavels back. And the one thing they're all agreed on is it's going to take pulling together and being a united caucus. Mm. And that's, I think, his key job.
Well, meanwhile, Rick Klein of the Boston Globe is standing by to talk about the Democrats and the House. But before we let you go, Gail, you sound like you're right in the thick of it there. What else is going on today besides this jockeying for position? If you could just touch on the Senate Armed Services Committee is meeting.
I think that's an incredibly important hearing. You know, both Republicans and Democrats heard clearly from the voters that they are not satisfied with the Iraq policy. And starting a half an hour ago, you had Senate Republicans and Democrats, Warner and Levin, convening their first hearing where they have General Abizaid in front of them, and they'll ask him directly, how are things going? What do we need? What kind of change of course is needed? And, of course, part of that is going to be a closed session, the most interesting part. But you're seeing the start of what's going to be a very long and intense period of reexamining where we are in Iraq and how to get out.
We understand that in the exchanges today, the Democrat leader has asked for a 4 to 6 month timetable for withdrawal, and the general has replied that timetables limit flexibility. So setting up the debate there.
That's right.
Gail Chadwick, as always, of the Christian Science Monitor, we thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care. Well, now joining us from Washington, Rick Klein, congressional correspondent for the Boston Globe. And Rick, fill us in, watercolor the Democrats' position. On the Senate side, it was pretty predictable.
On the Warriors?
I'm sorry. on the leadership. We know Harry Reid of Nevada is majority leader.
Yes. Yeah, though there's no question about who the House Speaker will be. That'll be Nancy Pelosi of California. She's a shoo-in for it. The big question will be who the number two is, the post of majority leader, which is an important position, has an important public face, in some ways more high profile than the Speaker. That battle's between John Murtha of Pennsylvania, who made a lot of waves by coming out against the Iraq War last year, and Steny Hoyer of Maryland, who's the current number two in the House.
Well, you know, we've got about a minute before we take the break, Rick, but just in a few seconds, tell us, why is Nancy Pelosi roiling these waves so soon, you know, after the Democrats gain power, by setting up this debate between Murtha and Hoyer?
Well, she's endorsed Congressman Murtha, which surprised a lot of people, and there's a lot of speculation going around about why that is precisely. She, I know, has a lot of respect and has a long working relationship with Congressman Murtha. Congressman Hoyer actually challenged her for the minority leader's job after Dick Gephardt left the House to run for president. So there's some personal loyalty issues that are part of this, but this could really come back to bite her if she's not successful.
Rick Klein of the Boston Globe, we want to talk more about that and other things going on in Washington. We will do that with Rick Klein of the Boston Globe, find out what the freshman members of Congress did today. Much more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we're back with Rick Klein of the Boston Globe talking about all things Capitol Hill today, where there's a lot going on. And Rick, you were just saying that Speaker-in-Waiting Nancy Pelosi has endorsed Pennsylvania's John Murtha as the majority leader of the House, which sets up this battle with backers of Steny Hoyer of Maryland. He's the minority whip. And you explained that there was some personal, you know, background between Pelosi and Hoyer. They'd both competed for a job previously. But this is happening, as it reminds Americans that John Murtha was brushed by scandal, and we've been hearing all about that over the last day. Could you remind us of that?
Sure. I mean, really, it's a question for Democrats about the statement they want to take, and what some of Murtha's critics are doing is pointing out that 25 years ago he was very intricately involved in the Abscam scandal, which was a bad congressional scandal involving bribery of some members of Congress. He was actually an unindicted co-conspirator shown on tape. Not quite refusing a bribe, not ruling out taking it some in the future, but not accepting it either. So that's come back. Also, he is a member of the Appropriations Committee. He's known to have very close ties to lobbyists, accepting a good amount of money from them, steering contracts, government contracts in their direction. So all of this baggage is coming out now.
But on the other hand, I just want to jump in to say he was also one of the first and the most vocal to protest the war in Iraq. And is there a feeling that he should be rewarded for that because he was out on a limb for quite a while?
Well, he was. I wouldn't call him among the first, but he was among the first prominent hawks of the war,
sure,
and some of the supporters of the war who
to turn
out against.
Yes,
to turn against it. And it had a major sort of galvanizing moment for the Democrats during a time where they're having a hard time come up with a unified message on the war, to have this man, himself a Vietnam War hero, come out and denounce the war as stridently and strongly as he did. And actually Nancy Pelosi, among others, quickly followed in his footsteps. So he took a major courageous stand, and I think a lot of people who are uncomfortable with the war's progress feel like if the Democrats make their first move to make Murtha the majority leader, the number two spot, that it'll be sending a statement that Democrats are serious about changing direction in Iraq.
But as you say, it also has a whiff of past scandal, at least, when the Democrats came out promising the cleanest Congress ever. And it's divided Democrats, as we said, just as they've come to power. What do you think is going to happen here?
Well, I think the smart money seems to be on Hoyer, who's spent a lot more time on the campaign trail, visited some 80 districts, helped elect a lot of the freshmen that are part of this class, and a lot of those I expect will be with Congressman Hoyer. I think there's also presumption that he's a better vote counter because he has served as minority whip and very effectively over the last few years under Leader Pelosi. But this will be a test of Pelosi's sway here and whether she can help vault Congressman Murtha over the top. I know Murtha's supporters are very confident. Both sides always exude optimism going into one of these elections. So you have to take all of their vote counts with a grain of salt, as well as their optimism with a grain of salt. But I do think most people expect Hoyer to hang on. If he does not, then it'll be a pretty major victory for Pelosi and obviously for Murtha.
I just want to touch on House Republicans briefly. They're scheduled to choose their new leaders on Friday. There's a race there as well.
There is, and this is an intriguing one as well. Speaker Hastert has said he's going to leave leadership and not seek any of the posts as part of leadership. So there's sort of a free-for-all, and most of the attention is going to go to the post of minority leader, which will be the top Republican in the House. John Boehner, who was Hastert's number two, who got that post after Tom DeLay left, is one of the candidates and seen as sort of a continuation of the Hastert legacy. And there's also the leader of the conservative wing of the party, the Republican Study Group, Mike Pence of Indiana, is in, and Joe Barton of Texas, who's the outgoing chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, sort of a wild card in the race. And basically, the pitch that Congressman Pence is making is that we, as a Republican Party, need to return to our conservative roots. We need to remember what got us to power originally, and that means, you know, getting rid of some of the folks in leadership who led us through a very rocky time.
Right. I want to give a picture of what else is going on today, because it just seems busy, like everybody's buying new furniture and trying to figure out who sits in one seat. The Blue Dog Democrats, this is the coalition of conservative to moderate Democrats, they held a press conference today. And it was, I would have to imagine, the biggest one they've ever had, because their ranks are now around 44. How much power are they going to have in the House?
There will be a considerable voting block. I mean, they will be necessary to pick off a good portion of them, or hold a good portion of them in the fray if the Democrats are going to win any votes this year. And one of the reasons that Democrats were able to win the majority in the House as well as in the Senate was that they had a lot of recruiting that focused heavily on finding people that fit the districts. That meant finding people who don't fit the Democratic mold of the traditional Northeastern liberal mold that Republicans would have you believe is the entire party. So it meant finding a lot of conservative candidates in states like Indiana and Kentucky, where the Democrats had some big pickups, and also in states like Pennsylvania and Ohio. You had people who are very much budget hawks. They want to make sure that the budget is balanced. They're not big fans of big tax cuts. Tax hikes, and they're not big fans of big government programs. So it's going to be a challenge. The committees are largely led by these old lion liberals who've been out of power for a long time and got long legislative agendas, things they'd like to accomplish. But they'll have to deal with this much larger, empowered block of conservatives.
Well, and Rick Klein, a couple minutes before we let you go, there's also what seems to us an interesting scene happening, unfolding, as the freshman members of the House attended a breakfast today with the House leadership. With more than 50 new members of Congress in Washington, some races are still contested. And we understand that in those contested races, both candidates are there.
Yeah, it's interesting. Actually, in the past, there's even been leadership elections that have been decided on the votes of people who've never become members of Congress because of the schedule of how this works out. It's interesting. The freshman orientation began on Monday and continues through this week. They don't waste much time in terms of letting these newly elected House members and senators know how they have to do their jobs, because it's not just showing up and voting. It's setting up an office. It's hiring a staff. It's finding out how to answer the phones and moving the furniture in and picking out office space and computers. So there's a lot to learn in a pretty short period of time. But, yeah, you're right. Some of the people who are going through orientation will never actually be seated as members of Congress.
That's an odd thing. And we understand that, for example, Republican Vern Buchanan and Democrat Christine Jennings of Florida's 13th House District keep bumping into each other, and they've been competitors.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. In fact, I talked to one freshman who relayed a story of going to the White House on Monday night, where they had a big reception, and they all were interested to see Laura Bush, who had showed up and actually campaigned against most of the people in that room at some point.
Rick Klein, congressional correspondent for the Boston Globe, as people make their way around their new housing in Washington. Rick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And coming up, U.S. Airways is trying to take over Delta Airlines, but will the democratically controlled Congress allow it? That's ahead. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. U.S. Airways is making a hostile bid to buy bankrupt Delta Airlines for $8 billion in cash, a move that would, if completed, create one of the world's largest airlines. And the move comes as the airline industry is showing signs of returning to profitability after 9/11. So travelers and airline workers alike are wondering, what does this mean for me? Well, joining us on the line from Chicago, where he's reporting on the story, is Doug Cameron, airline industry correspondent for the Financial Times. And Doug, first of all, explain to us a merger on this on the most elementary level. How can U.S. Airways do this if Delta reportedly doesn't want it? That's what makes it hostile. So how does that work?
This is an audacious move by Doug Parker, the chief executive of U.S. Airways. He's basically appealing to the unsecured creditors who effectively control Delta now because it's been in bankruptcy. Delta's management has rejected attempts by Mr. Parker to merge in the past, so Mr. Parker is now going over their heads.
Delta is claiming that it can realign itself.
Delta is claiming it can realign itself with very good reasons. Firstly, it is sorting itself out operationally. It's moving towards profit after many years of losses. Secondly, it has won around its unions and employees. And the history of airline mergers are, if you don't get the employees on side, you can't make the deal work.
Right.
I think U.S. Airways, there's a whiff of urgency, even desperation, about the timing of this move. It wants to sort out a deal before Delta emerges from bankruptcy next year, because half of the synergies that it would capture from the proposed transaction, it would lose when Delta emerges from bankruptcy. It has to do it now. Unfortunately, the timing is very bad from both a regulatory and labor relations point of view.
What do you mean by that?
There are two things. To paraphrase Dickens, it's the best of times, the worst of times. There is this window of opportunity for two reasons. There are regulatory and labor problems. On the labor side, you have a new Democratic leadership in Congress. If you go back to previous merger attempts in 2000, they were strongly opposed by the Democrats then in opposition, who are now obviously in control of Congress, largely because of fears that there would be large-scale job losses and that fares would rise. While Mr. Parker contends that there would be no compulsory job losses and fares wouldn't rise, he would say that, wouldn't he? But he's going to have a tough sell in Congress, never mind with antitrust regulators. From the union side, Delta and its one union, the pilots, are pretty much aligned now, as are the other employee groups. They believe they're working together now to have a sustainable airline. Airline unions across the U.S. are now becoming increasingly restless because the industry is moving into profitability. They feel they've taken the pain over the past 5 years, and they want to see some of the gains, and there are loud calls from unions now to be more active in terms of securing those gains.
And this might be a stupid question. We've spoken a little bit about why Delta doesn't want to have a hostile takeover. Why would U.S. Airways want Delta?
Acquiring Delta would be a step change in U.S. Airways' size, scope, and scale. It would truly put them on the global map. They are effectively a domestic carrier now with a small international operation. This would leapfrog them from fifth to number one in the US market, assuming that they don't shrink too much. It would give them a large international fleet, a large international network, and take them for the first time into the Global Alliance network and kind of give them a seat at the global airline table.
Right, the big table. Well, we understand if this goes through, the new airline would operate under the Delta name. Delta currently has hubs in Atlanta, Cincinnati, and Salt Lake City. U.S. Airways has hubs in Phoenix, Philadelphia, and Charlotte, North Carolina. Where would the new airline be based?
Mr. Parker contends he will keep all the assets, but he's far too smart a manager to actually mean that in practice. Charlotte and Atlanta are too close together to operate efficiently. One of those would have to go. Cincinnati and Pittsburgh, equally too close. It would make sense in the long term for one of those to be certainly downsized. So I think you would be looking in the longer term at a very different operation from that which the two carriers currently operate.
And yet, as you pointed out, the head of U.S. Airways is maintaining that there would not be a lot of job loss. So I want your opinion now. Who do you think will benefit from this merger? Will the workers? Will the stockholders? Will the travelers?
The one group that won't benefit are the stockholders at Delta who've been effectively wiped out by the bankruptcy. The unsecured creditors would certainly stand to benefit. Employees, it's a real toss-up. In theory, employees keep their jobs. At the same time, airlines are always looking to ratchet down costs, and when agreements do come up for renegotiation in the future, they can be management is going to ask them for perhaps further concessions to keep this larger airline competitive.
And so, you know, what about the travelers? We understand that one of the ideas that U.S. Airway CEO Doug Parker is floating is that he might get rid of the Delta shuttle that operates here in the Northeast. We've been chuckling about a report that just came out that said that the shuttle flight from Washington to New York is late 100% of the time. But we know that these shuttles, which fly primarily when business people fly, can be a source of income. So what will that mean if he gets rid of the shuttle, for instance?
Well, you have to remember that both Delta and U.S. Airways both have a shuttle each, so one would be disposed as a way to secure regulatory approval. But Mr. Parker has said today that there would be no closure of services from any of the cities that the two airlines currently operate. What you have to work out then is the sort of competitive response from rivals as to whether rivals make up for that apparent reduction in competition from the merger. That's a tough task for the Department of Justice to try and work out, but that's where the battle is going to be, as well as with the unions going forward.
And overall, what about consumers? Do they win here?
Consumers will win if there are cheap fares. The problem is that cheap fares over the past 5 years have bankrupted five airlines, so consumers have had a pretty good run, to be honest, in the airline industry, and it's a simple fact that for the services to continue to operate, people have to kind of pay for it.
Doug Cameron, airline industry correspondent for the Financial Times. Do you think this deal will go through?
I think it'll be blocked on regulatory and political grounds.
Oh. So it just sort of makes everything we just talked about kind of moot.
Yep. Hey, you asked the question.
Doug, thank you.
Cheers. Bye.
And we have these news notes from the world of television. Fox TV says it plans to air an interview with O.J. Simpson in late November. The interview, according to Fox, will be unrestricted. The title of the program, If I Did It, Here's How It Happened. The same title of a new Simpson book. Simpson is, of course, the former football star who was charged and eventually acquitted of murdering his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Ronald Goldman. He was then found liable for the two deaths in a civil trial in 1997. The interview will air during the all-important TV sweeps period. Book publisher Judith Regan will conduct the interview with Simpson. His book, which Regan is publishing, will go on sale the day after the Fox broadcast. And one more note from the world of television.
It's November the 15th, day one of a new era in television news.
I'm Shirley Ghosh.
And I'm Sami Zeidan. This is Al Jazeera.
Al Jazeera's English language channel went on the air this morning, broadcasting from the station's headquarters in the tiny Persian Gulf state of Qatar. Al Jazeera, which is bankrolled by Qatar's royal family, said its signal would reach more than 80 million households in the Middle East and Europe, mainly through cable and satellite. It hopes to steal viewers from CNN and the BBC by giving the world's 1 billion English speakers news from a non-Western perspective. It still lacks a distributor in the U.S. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, this is Geography Awareness Week, and it's not a moment too soon. A recent survey by National Geographic and Roper Public Affairs found that many young Americans are geographically illiterate. 6 out of 10 Americans aged 18 to 24 can't find Iraq on a map of the Middle East. And when given a map of a hypothetical place and told to go northwest to escape a hurricane, 1/3 of the kids went the wrong way. Well, we called Barbara Chow, Vice President of Education and Children's Programs at National Geographic, and asked her, why is there so little awareness of geography?
I think that the challenge is that geography is just simply not supported adequately in the schools these days. What we found is that when kids are getting the exposure to it, they really are interested in it. It's a fascinating subject, and I think they love it when they have the chance to really interact with it.
But so you're saying they're not getting taught it in school anymore? Is that
It's not getting taught nearly to the extent that it was at one point. It's really starting to fall off the curriculum. Reading and math, which are really emphasized heavily these days, are starting to crowd out the other disciplines. So we're starting to lose some of the gains that we'd made about 10 years ago in geography, and we're seeing the impacts of that on the kinds of surveys that we've been conducting.
Do you have a sense of some of the things that kids don't know? I mean, I know that's sort of a backwards question, but do they not know where countries are, or do they not know that countries exist? Or
I think they don't have a sense of how the world fits together and sort of what their place is within that broader construct, and that's what worries us most.
That's what you're talking about when you say geography.
Yeah. What geography does when it's really well taught is it provides you a context, a sort of a framework for understanding the very complex issues that we're dealing with these days. And when you think about it, all these big issues that are going to be coming up over the next few decades, from climate change to conflicts over water and energy, culture wars, the globalization of the economy, outsourcing of jobs, all of those have a huge geographic challenge, I think, at the heart of these issues. And understanding how people relate to them, I think, will be essential for our success in the 21st century.
Yeah. Well, you have some samples from the 2005 National Geographic Bee, and I'm already sweating here. Ask me some of the questions that were on that bee.
Sure. Let me just throw out a few of these, and let's see how you do with them. Let's start with one maybe closer to home. Which state is known as the Pelican State because pelicans are native to its Gulf Coast? And I'm going to give you two choices.
Oh, God.
It's Maryland or Louisiana.
Oh, see, I would have said Florida. Okay. I'm going to go with Louisiana.
You're right.
Woo!
Absolutely.
Thank you.
A couple other questions. The central highlands of an island country in the Indian Ocean produce almost 10% of the world's tea. Name this country.
Madagascar, Sri Lanka, Indonesian islands. Singapore?
The answer is Sri Lanka.
I had that. That was in there.
mentioned that there. So that's very good. Excellent. Okay, one more. The ruins of Persepolis, an ancient ceremonial capital of Persia,
right,
are located in which present-day country?
Iran!
Ah, excellent, excellent.
You know, I know that.
Good job.
We just had the author on who wrote about Persepolis, the wonderful graphic artist. Well, but these are kind of hard questions. But I suppose we should know that Louisiana is the Pelican State, or tea comes from Sri Lanka.
These are part of our daily life. Tea, you know, we love tea, and it's good to know where it comes from, and it's good to know a little bit about the rest of the world in which we're interacting. So, and these are tougher questions than, quite frankly, we asked in the Roper survey, which we asked of 18 to 24-year-olds. So,
give us one of the easier questions that you asked kids.
If it is noon in New York City, what time is it in Los Angeles?
If it's noon, oh, this is where my head explodes. If it's noon in New York City,
in New York City, what time would it be in Los Angeles?
3 hours earlier in Los Angeles, so 9 a.m. But kids didn't know that, huh?
Yeah, and again, you can imagine why that might be important. if you're ever scheduling a business call and you want to talk to your colleagues over in the West Coast and you don't understand the concept of time differences, then it will be pretty hard to get everybody on the same call.
In the meantime, we know that National Geographic is leading a public engagement campaign called My Wonderful World with a website, mywonderfulworld.org. We'll have more about that on our website, here-now.org. Barbara Chow, Vice President of Education and Children's Programs at National Geographic, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Well, stay with us. We're in Boston, Massachusetts, East Coast, USA. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There was a time when rock and roll was called the devil's music, but long before that, the Catholic Church banned the interval between C and F sharp. It's an interval known as the tritone. It's this sound. That augmented fourth, sung there by Tony in West Side Story, was considered so dissonant that it had to be the spawn of Satan, or Diabolus in Musica. Music, and how we take it in, that's Daniel Levitin's obsession. A successful studio engineer, Levitin then joined academia, which led him to the study of neuroscience and to his new book, This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of a Human Obsession. And Daniel Levitin joins us now in the studio. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
You know, I always thought there was a little something going on when Tony sang that about Maria.
Something devilish in his mind, maybe?
There's something there. In fact, you know, I have always personally had a thing for B flat. Is that possible, that notes can spark that reaction in
us? Absolutely. In fact, you know, people who have absolute pitch have different kinds of associations or feeling towards the different notes.
But even those who don't know anything about music, you say, will have reactions to certain kinds of music. For instance, a single high note will make us feel excitement, a single low note, sadness.
There are these general principles that composers know, and of course they don't work all the time for everybody, but they're, you know, as a general principle, high notes convey excitement, low notes convey sadness. Fast notes convey happiness or agitation. Slow notes convey something more ominous or sad.
Right. Major scales, happy. Minor scales, sad. But is this, I mean, are these reactions that we have to music, is this innate or is it cultural? Because different cultures might have different reactions.
Well, that's a good question. Some of it is cultural. So this major minor thing that we're talking about, it's not a cultural universal at all. Middle Eastern culture, there's a lot of minor chords in the music, and they're not all interpreted as sad the way we've learned to interpret them.
Right. And let's give an example here of a major minor. It's the Doors' Light My Fire. It starts in the minor and switches to a major.
The time to hesitate is through. The time to wallow in the mire. Try now, we can only lose. And our love become a funeral pyre. Come, oh baby, light my fire. Come, oh baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire.
I like this example because you get the kind of ambiguity of the minor chords during the verse. You know that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar. And then there's this majestic payoff when Jim Morrison moves to the major key for Come On Baby, Light My Fire.
Right. But in another culture, might somebody have a majestic payoff and it be in a minor?
Absolutely.
Right. Well, something's going on because you write people spend more on music than on sex or prescription drugs. Why? Is there something, the equivalent in music, you know, that compels people the way, you know, you can get addicted to a drug?
Well, music does activate some of the same neural centers as drugs and other pleasurable experiences do. And I draw this out in the book. For example, if you eat chocolate or if you have an orgasm, there's a cluster of neurons that fire, signaling pleasure. And they also fire when you hear music that you like.
Interesting.
Or notes that you like.
And you write, too, that there's something called mirroring, where somebody just watching in the audience, a musician on stage, will have their neurons in the audience will fire in the same way that the person actually playing the music.
This is one of the newest discoveries in cognitive neuroscience, the idea of mirror neurons. They were first discovered by monkeys who were watching other monkeys eat food. And the hands of the monkeys watching another monkey peel a banana, the representation in the brain of their hands started to fire, even though they weren't actually peeling the banana themselves.
Right. So that thing you're feeling in the audience, you really are. When you're playing air guitar, your brain may actually be playing guitar.
That's right.
You say all of our brains, though, are wired to timing. First of all, explain, what do you mean by timing?
We know from memory theorists that almost everything you've experienced is preserved in your brain. And the question is, if you've heard a piece of music many, many times, have you incorporated some regularities of it? The pitch, the rhythm structure, the tempo. And I did an experiment where I just had people come in off the street and sing their favorite pop songs in order to ask the question, are they singing them in the right key and at the right tempo? If their memory has really encoded, like a tape recorder, that song, then they ought to be able to do it. Let's try with you.
Well, here's the thing. We don't have my favorites here, but we did find the White Album from the Beatles. So it's Obladi Oblada, which I think
so
I
So before we play it, then, imagine that it's playing in your head and sing along with that imagination whenever you're ready.
Dun, 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 dun.
So we've got a tempo going, and we've got some pitch. Now let's go.
Hit it, Doug.
You were a little bit faster, but not much.
Am I hot? Was I low?
You were right there.
Close. Was I?
I think so.
All right, everybody.
I lost track of what you were doing before it came on.
Well, that's later. And what does this say to you?
Well, the tempo is really interesting because you could have sung it at any speed, and you sang it very, very close to the actual. You were a little bit faster, but that's
I'm
normal.
I'm nervous.
Yeah, well, that's normal. You're a little nervous. You haven't sung on national radio a lot.
In a week. but what does that say to you? That people, what, that they... That...
Well, it says something about memory. We remember aspects of the world with high fidelity, if you will, with great resolution and accuracy.
You say that artists like Pink Floyd's Dave Gilmour, Pat Metheny, use multiple delays of signal to stimulate our brains. And what do you mean by that? Because we want to hear, let's listen in a moment to a little of Dave Gilmour. We have
well,
that. But what do you mean by that?
This is something I first heard when I was living here in Boston and I was a student at Berkeley, and I would go up to Central Square and hear Pat Metheny play every chance I could get. And he had this sound I had never heard before. It was, his guitar sound was just different. And I asked him about it, and he had this rack of equipment called digital delays, which were brand new at the time. And what they do is they delay the sound like this, 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 this.
Hmm.
So if you were talking, you could adjust how you want the repeat to be. And he and Dave Gilmour of Pink Floyd have made this part of their arsenal of sounds that they use.
And what does that do to us, the listener?
Well, it does something funny to the brain because the brain has evolved over tens of thousands of years living in natural environments, not listening to electronic machines. So when the brain hears that, it's trying to figure out where that comes from. And the only reference it has is thousands of years of living in caves and enclosed spaces. And we used our sense of delay to help navigate in the dark in these caves. So the brain is sort of fooled into thinking that we're in some funny acoustic space. And, of course, we're not.
Right.
And I think it's an interesting thing for the game. It's kind of like, for the brain, it's kind of like a tickle.
Daniel Levitan, the author of This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of a Human Obsession. For more on the book, go to our website, here-now.org. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you, Rob.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.